Algorithms are everywhere you look. Google, Facebook, even retailers are using in-store algorithms to sell us more stuff. But are algorithms fair or just opinions embedded in code? This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with the author of Weapons of Math Destruction. And that conversation starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening, as always. We start this week with something that is seemingly invisible but ubiquitous, like faith or oxygen. But it's the algorithm. Simply put, we live in an algorithmic age. From Google searches to college admissions to car loans, algorithms affect almost all parts of our daily lives. Now, the question is, are algorithms the banality of evil or the force of equality? And the answer is likely somewhere in between. Like all technology, it's amoral. It's how the technology is applied that counts. Like with a hammer, I can smash a glass door or I can build a house, that sort of thing. One woman, scientist and author, saw algorithms from the inside in two distinct applications in business and did not like what she saw either time. So she wrote a book titled Weapons of Math Destruction: How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Part one of my conversation with her starts now.
Kathy O'Neill, I'm a data scientist, mathematician, and author of Weapons of Math Destruction.
Yeah, and I'd like to mention the subtitle because I want to start there. It's How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. So I'll just start at the very, very beginning. What was the impetus for the book?
Well, I was a mathematician, trained as a mathematician, but then I decided to join finance as a quant in 2006, and I did, and I joined a hedge fund, and as soon as I joined, we went immediately into the financial crisis. But I can go on about that, but the short version is, like, 4 years later, I left finance kind of disgusted with what I'd seen, disillusioned, not wanting to be part of a problem, but wanting to, you know, sort of have my hands clean. I had to have a job, so I became a data scientist. And I was basically, as far as I could tell, the only person that had been in finance that went into data science, at least in my community. And so I was all of a sudden, like, with a bunch of people who were very, very positive. Like, they'd really drunk the Kool-Aid on the sort of world of big data and technology, and they assumed that whatever they were doing was going to be good for the world without really thinking too hard about it. But, of course, I had come from the dark side, so I was, like, more cynical, more skeptical, I would say, because I don't really think of myself as a cynical person. I am hopeful. But what I saw was that the same kinds of mistakes that we had made in finance were being made in the world of big data. But instead of the sort of long-term consequence being a broken market and a financial crisis, which is what had happened when we made these huge mistakes in finance, the long-term effect in the world of data science and big data were going to be harder to measure. The failures would happen at an individual level because instead of affecting markets, we're affecting individuals. So when we see failure, we don't actually see failure. When we build an algorithm that fails, it fails at the individual level. So we have people who should have gotten a job but didn't get a job, people who should have gotten a credit card but didn't get a credit card. And those people would never know about each other. They would never know that they were part of a larger failure. And I saw that happening all around me. And not only did it happen a lot, but it sort of happened to the same people over and over again. Because at the end of the day, I was building these algorithms, and my job was to separate winners from losers. And I was doing it the same way everyone else who had my job was doing it, which is to say I was defining losers using the same definitions that we've always used.
Right.
People who are poor, people who are minority, people who have disability in one way or another, people in general who have been sort of statistically unlucky. So we looked at historically unlucky people, and then we said, we're going to predict that these people were going to be lucky in the future. But what we failed to anticipate is that when you build these algorithms, we call them predictive algorithms, they don't just predict what's going to happen, they cause the future.
Right.
So when we predict people are unlucky and we refrain from offering them opportunities, what that actually means is, since we're doing the same thing everyone else is doing, is that unlucky people are living in an environment where nobody thinks they're going to do well, nobody gives them an opportunity. Lucky people have been deemed lucky by every single algorithm out there, so they're going to be given opportunities. And that's where you see increased inequality, because you just see this very large-scale social mobility issue coming in, where unlucky people stay unlucky or even get unluckier. Lucky people stay lucky or get luckier. Mm-hmm. And so you have this widening schism between classes.
Thank you for that, because it kind of leads to one of the points of the book, which was algorithms are equivalent to and equal to just decisions. And you mentioned there that predictive algorithms, which are not really predictive, are there possibilities for dynamic algorithms, or are algorithms replacing human intuition, and in what way?
Well, so they're certainly replacing human decision-making because they're so easy to scale. And so they save a lot of time and money, and they produce efficiencies for businesses that use them. And so they're very attractive to businesses, especially businesses that are bureaucratic and make sort of consistently complicated but consistent decisions, things like who deserves an insurance rate,
right,
a policy of, you know, like this, who deserves this credit card, that kind of thing. So they're absolutely being picked up by pretty much every bureaucratic system that's around, that's quantitative.
Okay.
What they fail to do, and this is the important distinction between an algorithm and a human, what they fail to do is ever ask the question why. And so that's going back to your point, which is that, are they predictive? Well, I mean, in the sense that people are consistent with their behaviors, they are. So in the sense that people who bought things on Expedia.com tend to buy things on Expedia.com more than people who haven't ever bought anything on Expedia.com.
Okay.
So in that sense, they are predictive. They sort of, they've noticed a certain behavior pattern from a certain group of people and predict that since it happened in the past, it'll happen in the future. Of course, it's not causal whatsoever. It's not a proof. It's just statistical evidence that people who did X in the past will do X in the future. That's all it is. And it's really that dumb. One of the things that I really want to make it clear about is that this stuff is not deep. It's just pattern matching.
Right.
So there's no reason to sort of have any kind of awe or, you know, to be awed by the sophistication of the mathematics involved. No, it's in terms of human behavior prediction, it is really pretty dumb. It's just patterns. And anybody could do that. The point is, though, that it would be a very boring job. It would be very hard to scale a given person pattern matching for millions and millions of Expedia.com users or billions of Facebook users.
Right.
So instead of having a human being doing that, you have an algorithm doing that, because it's much, much faster at doing it. Doesn't mean it's smart, though. It's not at all smart.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned pattern recognition, of course, and it almost sounds like institutionalized in a certain way. And you have a phrase that you use in the book and in your TED Talk, which was opinions embedded in code. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. This was my own experience, to be clear. Like, when I was building algorithms, one of the things I noticed right away was that two different data scientists, like myself and one other person, if we were given the same directions by our boss, we'd come up with completely different algorithms to do the same thing. So when I say the same thing, the directions from our boss would be like, find out who the users are that are like more likely to purchase this item.
I see.
We would have lots and lots of leeway to decide what kind of attributes to collect about those people, about the users, like what kind of algorithm, underlying mathematical algorithm to apply, what the threshold should be, so the cutoff of people who are deemed highly likely to do this, unlikely to do this. In other words, we were making a lot of decisions, and
right,
many of those decisions were extremely subjective. Some of them were downright ethical decisions.
Right, you're making assumptions, right?
You're making assumptions. You're making assumptions like somebody's geolocation should matter. And by the way, if this was an offer rather than just a prediction of purchase, if this was an offer like we're going to offer some people coupons, other people won't get coupons, then you're really talking about an opportunity that we're going to deny people because of their zip code. Now, between you and me, zip code in this country is highly correlated to race. So if you think at all deeply, and I'm not going that deep, right?
Right.
Just at all deeply, I'm saying I'm going to deny people in certain zip codes this opportunity based on their race.
Hmm.
And as soon as you frame it that way, you're like, whoa, this is an ethical decision.
Right.
But that's not how it's framed in the world of algorithms. In the world of algorithms, you're treated as if you're a PhD in mathematics or whatever it is, statistics. I happen to be a mathematician. You know, so therefore, whatever you're doing is objective scientific truth. And it's far from the case. I decide I'm going to use zip code or I'm not going to use zip code. I'm going to use, you know, demographic information about people to decide whether they deserve or do not deserve this option in their life.
So if you wanted to push back against the assumptions that are embedded in the code of an algorithm, is there recourse for the user? I guess what I'm asking is, like, are we just subjected to algorithms and just cross our fingers and hope?
Almost always that is the case. And that is one of the scariest things about this. Now, when I say that, it's very important to realize that many of these algorithms are relatively benign. Many of the algorithms are things that you don't actually mind that much, that people are making decisions about you right. without consulting you or allowing you to correct the records. So for many of the ads you see when you go to a random website will be decided about you. And you might not mind because you might actually have an ad blocker and not even see them.
Right.
Other decisions made about you matter a lot. So whether you're in college, what kind of credit card you get, whether you go to prison and how long you go to prison, whether police come to your neighborhood. These are things that could really affect your life. Oh, and one of the most important examples I have in my book, the sort of the example that got me into writing the book in the first place, were teachers whose jobs were on the line based on some opaque statistical system that was supposed to assess them as teachers. Were they doing a good job as teachers, as public high school teachers? These were almost random number generators. They were very, very unrobust statistical models, and yet teachers were losing their job if they had bad scores. That matters a lot. And in those cases, even in those cases, I should say, the teachers were not truly explained what was happening to them. The formulas were not explained to them. And in fact, something else happened entirely, which as a mathematician, I am ashamed of. Somebody's described it as math-splaining or math-washing. Where they, instead of, when they ask, could you explain why I'm getting fired? Can you explain why my score is so low? Instead of an explanation, they were told, it's math, you wouldn't understand it. So you literally have this sort of authority of the inscrutable. This is so complicated that you aren't smart enough, you're not an expert enough, you're not, you know, sophisticated enough to understand this, and it's your own fault because you're not a math PhD.
Right.
That is, of course, a weaponization of mathematics, which is supposed to be explaining things, clarifying things, and instead it's being used to intimidate people and to keep them quiet about things that are actually their right to know. Just a couple of months ago in Houston, six teachers who had gotten fired based on a very similar scoring system to what I was describing in the book, they appealed, and the judge found that their due process rights, constitutional due process rights, had been violated because they'd been fired with a score that no one could explain to them. This is where I get hopeful. There is pushback, and potentially there's lots of pushback. My goal in the next 10 years is to sort of push this idea that we have. Our legal system right now just doesn't have the teeth it needs to push back against this new mechanism of algorithms, but we need to develop those teeth. And what that might look like is some kind of like a data bill of rights for people. And I don't just mean consumers, because
right.
I think we spend a little bit too much time, especially in the world of antitrust, we spend too much time thinking about consumers and how consumers are served. I mean as citizens. As citizens, we have basic rights to understand how data is collected about us, how data is used against us, how we're scored, whether these scoring systems fail, for whom do they fail? Do they fail more for women than for men? Do they fail more for African Americans than for whites? Like, why do these algorithms work or fail? And they need to be explained enough to us so that we know that it's fair.
That was Kathy O'Neill. She's a former financial quant and the present author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Among the many topics Ms. O'Neill covers in her examination of algorithmic effects on society, I'm going to point out an afterword in her book that addresses a top-of-mind topic, fake news. She examines not only how news outlet algorithms failed to predict the 2016 election, but also how the algos help bad actors spread fake news and disinformation. And that accusation is gaining more momentum recently, with an early investor in Facebook now calling the platform a, quote, living, breathing crime scene, end quote. Coming up after the break, we have part two of my chat with author and mathematician Kathy O'Neill. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics. Please come on back.